Wow. Y'all came back. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I appreciate the love y'all have shown podcast recently. Welcome back to Players of the New School, the podcast. Again, I am your host, Jasmine Baker, a.k.a. We Got Game 2 on all social media, a.k.a. your favorite women's sports culturalist. Definitely a mouthful. On this particular episode, I'm very excited to introduce you to one of your favorite people in sports you didn't even know existed, Thomas O'Grady. This man is basically the Wizard of Oz when it comes to sports jerseys and apparel. This your guy. Dude, single-handedly, well, he had a team. To be fair, he had a team. But they came up with the concept for the first 8 WNBA teams' jerseys. He's done MLB All-Star Weekends. He's done All-Star Weekends. Some of your favorite jersey designs, that was him. You have him to thank. So, without further ado, let's just hop right into this episode, because it's definitely one of my favorites. It's a two-parter. So if you don't care about jerseys, this is definitely not the episode for you. However, if you want to catch some tea, I highly recommend y'all check out the part one and part two of this episode. It was a lot of fun talking to him, getting insight into the early years of the WNBA. It was, oh my gosh. Y'all know I'm a geek when it comes to this stuff. So early on when it came to the WNBA, he was the brand architect for the launch of the WNBA. He took care of the naming and design of the first eight teams, like I said, the Spalding Ball design. He talked about that process. He talked about how even early on, the ball had an impact on youth in America at a very early on. It's very interesting to listen to him coming up with the process and talking about his team and how David Stern felt about the jerseys and just their entire process when it came to putting together the first season of the WNBA. So intriguing. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Thomas O'Grady, founder and chief creative officer of Game Plan Creative, based in Chicago.
I mean, when we set out, we said, well, what, we have a clean slate here. No one's really ever really done a very long-term professional women's basketball league. So what kind of things do we want to do to make the game the same, yet make the game different? That was really important right out of the starting gate. And, you know, the first thing that comes into play is the ball, you know. And so we had seen what the ABA had back in the 60s and the 70s with the red, white, and blue ball. And we thought for a moment, maybe that's something we should go back to and use that, you know. But then right off the bat, after maybe just a couple of days of thinking about it as a group, we said, that's a little bit too much like a Me Too. It's not special enough for us to come out with something like that. So we went about the process of grabbing balls from Spalding, a lot of basketballs, and taking out paint and starting to paint the panels in different ways with literally, like, you know, hobby shop paint. It wasn't a very sophisticated process, but the goal was to take those basketballs and then take them to Madison Square Garden. Since our office was down on Fifth Avenue, we weren't far from the garden, and do broadcast tests. So to take the different balls, and we must have had 10 different color palettes, from a black panel, orange panel, black panel, orange panel, which started looking like a pumpkin, to a blue basketball, this light blue, beautiful light blue, almost like Chicago sky color blue basketball, all blue. And so, because we just said, let's try almost everything. No was not acceptable at that point. You know, it was just like, let's give it a shot. And we had a ball that was a two-tone, which was the orange and then this kind of oatmeal color, almost like it was like a leather baseball glove, you know, but a little bit lighter. And we had a black ball, and it was like that wasn't going to work because it was too dark on broadcast. But it was in the mix. When we went to do the testing, ironically, the light blue ball tested the best. It was almost like glowing on the camera. And we're watching this thing unfold, and none of us saw that coming. And we're like, wow, Yeah, when we got the broadcast tape back, because this is 1994, we weren't doing a lot of HD stuff yet. We looked at this and we said, "My God, it's glowing! You know, that's really nice." But it felt like a ploy. It felt too much like a trick. And the orange and oatmeal ball. What we loved about it was when the ball was shot, you could see the spin and the rotation on the ball. And so we thought, as we begin to teach young girls how to play the game through the WNBA, we should have that. And it's almost like a learning device. So when they have the proper shot and the follow through with the wrist, with the proper rotation or how the ball bounces off the rim, we felt like that was going to be a big hit, not only because it looked different than the NBA ball, although it looked similar, but it had these performance attributes that would bring it one step higher. We also, over time, you know, I think the ball's slightly smaller. The diameter of the WNBA ball, just for better handling and whatnot, for the women, we also brought that into play. And that was the one thing. So that kind of, we were out of the starting gate. We had a basketball.
You know, you talk about, now that's amazing, because I think a lot of people have often wondered, because of it's a very, first of all, it's an iconic basketball now, because yes. of that colorway with oatmeal and orange, and specifically, people always say white and orange, and I'm always like, no, it's oatmeal, but.
You could see how I was trained, right? I never even brought up white, because. We did want it to be an off. We wanted it to be an off leather. We had one that was, like I said, a little deeper, almost like a baseball glove. But you didn't see enough of the contrast, you know. So that oatmeal color gave it enough, you know. Kind of, if the ABA ball and the NBA ball kind of came together, that's right. Probably what you'd put together, you know.
Yeah, you know, and again, like I said, it looks great on the screen. Yeah. I think that was one of the biggest things that's always stood out about the WNBA basketball is it looks great on screen in terms of you're able, like you said, because you're able to know what that rotation is supposed to look like.
It's yeah.
Great. Now, yes. My question is, when the ball was, I guess, initially put out there, and I don't know how so was tested with players or even with fans, but what was the reception like with players and fans?
Well, when we started, so that's a great question. So when we really started thinking about actually pulling this together, one of the first things we went and did says, and we did was like, we need to promote the league. So we're going to have to find two or three or four WNBA, you know, gonna-bes to promote basketball because we don't have any teams, logos, identities, or anything. So we got Cheryl Swoops and Rebecca Logo and Cynthia Cooper to kind of be the first three, you know, WNBA players without franchises. They would be the go-to players that we would lean on to give us the litmus test to know when too far was too far or when far was not far enough. To help guide us to, you know, make sure that they wouldn't be either embarrassed or offended or confused by any of the things we were doing. We were lucky to have Val Ackerman, who was, an athlete in college, and so she was a good test for us. But people who worked on the NBA brand for a long time, our voices were important, but they were not critical in the decision-making process. We would just serve the meals and then they would consume and say, I like this, too much spice, you know, and we used Rebecca, Cheryl, and Cynthia a lot to get us to a point where, you know, we felt like every time we made a decision and made an announcement, they needed to be part of it. So right from the start, they were kind of our ambassadors, you know, and they've proven to be over, 23, 24 years, still rock solid people that, you know, we can go to and say, hey, that's kind of the Mount Rushmore of the early days of the WNBA. So no, that was all by design, all on purpose, and wildly effective. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not sure if you heard the news where now Spalding is no longer the official ball, but Wilson is. And right. before they switched over, an executive at Spalding let me know that when they decided to do the balls and add the customization to them.
Yes.
That they ended up like completely going over the numbers that they anticipated. And I thought that spoke a lot, again, to your point about how iconic the ball still is. I know that in its first season, it sold well over 100,000 balls, which I think was, it speaks to the marketing and the strategies that you use. I think another one of the strategies that I think a lot of people don't pay attention to is early on, y'all had the ball in a bunch of the, in a lot of the logos for the team.
Yes. Yes.
Talk about that, how intentional you were about putting the ball in the logos.
It's funny because I joined the NBA in 1990, and I was their first creative director. And so the league exploded so quickly from when I walked in the door in June of 1990 to when the Dream Team was getting their gold medals. You know, I mean, that 2 year is like from riding in a horse and buggy to a Maserati. That's how quickly it exploded. And so almost simultaneously, we started thinking less about the NBA as a domestic brand, and we started thinking it quickly as a global brand that kids in Melbourne would like to know, you know, that the Milwaukee Bucks is a basketball team, or the Houston, you know, Rockets is a basketball team. And so we started slowly, as we started evolving and making updates to team identities, we said, wouldn't it be prudent of us to start to add the basketball into the NBA logos? Because we felt like, you know, we wanted recognition as this is a basketball team, a professional basketball team in the United States. And so that methodology was carried over into the WNBA. But with the NBA, it's like, you know, the Rockets it's all red ball. It's not the orange ball. It's all red because it is. But with the WNBA, we really tried to do the two paneling as much as we could to say, not only are these teams of the Women's Basketball League, but within the logo is the ball, you know? And so that was all by design. I think one or two, we didn't get in there. Like, I think like the Mercury, like there, you could see there's an orange thing in there, but it's really not the ball. One or two others didn't make it. So it wasn't a hard and fast rule, but when we could, we did. And I think it really worked out well for us. We were in the process, Jasmine, of going through this whole hierarchy of design. So you'd have a primary logo with the city name, like Houston, and then Comets, and then the ball flying around. And then we would take it and make a secondary logo, like the H, with just the little oval around it.
Right.
And so we use that for simpler executions because it was hard as a designer to try to throw everything in the kitchen sink in every logo that we did.
Right.
And so that to me, even when I look back on it today, some 23 years later, and I see, wow, the logos are great. They're so playful. They're so colorful. They're so whimsical. They have so much energy, but they're a little crowded, you know? But I love when I see the secondary logos as a standalone, like Liberty took their secondary logo.
Right.
Right. And now they've made it into their primary mark with just black and patina. And I think it's spectacular, you know, but it's a nice way to show after 23 years that it's almost like the Coke can. They're evolving it into new generations. And yet the ball is still part of the top of the Liberty look. You know, it's like, it's up there, you know, it's not orange and oatmeal, but it's in there.
Definitely.
So it was all done by design. It was all kind of learning quickly, but a lot of it was driven by the explosion of the Dream Team and the fact that we were now no longer a domestic brand. We were a global brand and we had to treat things in a much wider path. And so that's kind of how it all came together, you know? Yeah,
it makes sense. I think it's absolutely brilliant that your team was already thinking of the WNBA as a goal. How do we make them into a global brand from jump? And I love the idea of how you integrated that idea.
Now, when you
talk about, you know, the idea of a global brand, this all really started in, you know, when you talk about iconic logos. You talk about the first four seasons, everybody knew Houston. Everybody knew where Houston was located. Everybody knew who was on the team. Everybody knew what that logo looked like. And because everybody knew that logo meant you were winning. You were winning at
highest level possible. And everybody, even now to this day, anytime you talk about the big three, you talk about that team, there's so many people who have this nostalgia about that team that my Twitter feed just blows up anytime I tweet about that team. Can you talk about, because in one interview you were quoted saying creating the emotion of the logo, right? And I think you guys did that to the T. Can you talk about what it was like creating not only the Houston Comets logo, but even after they became, once y'all realized you had a dynasty with this team, how you made sure to throw them, I guess, even more in our faces, or I guess what was the process or strategy when it came to the Houston Comets as a dynasty?
I sometimes think people forget that Houston's the fourth largest market in the United States. So you've got, you have, you don't have an NHL hockey team there, right? And you have, you know, the Texans, I don't even know if the Texans are even playing yet, right? And so the Oilers had left, right? They were going up to Tennessee. And so you had the Astros, of course, right? And so that's, and the Rockets. And so you have that built-in incubator in the Rockets already, who were winning championships at the same time.
Right.
Right. So you had the 2 years that Michael decided to try to play baseball. Akeem and Clyde got, you know, they got their hardware. And so the timing of that was that jumped right into the WNBA. And so you, I think, and you could do the fact check on this, but I think that's a 6 year run of basketball championships in Houston, 94, 95, right? And then they won the first four, I believe. The maybe there was 1 year that they didn't, but it was a long run, right?
Oh, yeah, it was the first 4 years. So they were 96 through 2000.
And the Rockets ahead of them won, I think, those 2 years before. So you had a very, like, basketball hot town. It was like, I remember Clutch City was the Rockets thing. And and they were, that was a fun team to watch, too, with Akeem and Clyde. You know, that was a fun team. And Ori and all those guys. And so when Double T Tina and Cheryl and Cynthia came along, I mean, I think that's just, no pun intended, but the rocket ship had lifted off, you know, and they were just, they were part of that, you know. Mm-hmm. I think they were very likable players, and I think they were very accessible. So that's the real big difference. Not so much then, because even in the early 90s, I think our NBA guys were real accessible. I mean, I was there, and I used to do all these things, and we'd have these weird asks and weird favors, and these guys would be like, okay, they were really accommodating, you know, sometimes begrudgingly, but when they'd show up, they were pros, you know. And later on, that changed. But the WNBA players are always, like, very – you know, understand, they got the big picture. You know, I don't like to use the term, but they were pioneering. That's what they were doing. You know, it wasn't horse and buggy, but they were really pioneering. And so I think the part of their popularity was they were really good, number one. So there was a measure of excellence there. And I think that there was a certain, they had competition on their faces, really, like, they kind of sold that. And, you know, when the NBA first started, way back when, we had a team called the Minneapolis Lakers with George Mikan, and they went on a run early on, back in 1946, 47, 48, where they went through a run. And then there's the Celtics team that went on this 11, you know, Bill Russell championship run. And so I think at the advent of leagues, sometimes it's good to have a team that maybe is a somewhat semi-dynasty. Right. Because you get familiar with those faces and you get familiar with who's going to knock them off this year. Right. It's a lot like, I think, why people like to tune in to watch Bulls games. Who's going to finally knock off Michael, right? Because he was the hero and the anti-hero. And after The Last Dance and watching his attitude towards what winning meant to him, like, you wanted to see him go down if you weren't a Bulls fan. That guy's got to go down, right? And he didn't. And the same thing with that Rockets squad. I think that they really were a team that was resilient, and they were able to hang in there. I think that the first year, Teresa Weatherspoon hit a shot from past half court and kept that series alive. Yeah. And so there was excitement right out of the box. And there wasn't really – it seems like a lot of the teams were pretty equal early on, except for that Comets team. They just had a deep team, great coach, and that's why I think the fans fell in love with them. You know, I just think that you know, we have a saying in this, in sports, you know, winning is the best marketing plan of all time. So if you can't draw fans when you're winning championship after championship, something's wrong. But I also think that it's fun how the certain markets that we had, teams that names that matched, you know, I liked that connection, the brand connection of Rockets and Comets, you know, that one just like came together, or the Kings and the Monarchs. You know, even with the Jazz and the Stars, with the double Z, doing these little tricks, or the Hornets and the Sting, you know. There were certain markets that sat together, and so when the team played, it was almost like two in one team. You know, you were cheering for the Charlotte basketball teams, you know. One team happened to be men, one team happened to be women, but that was your markets, those are your teams. And so I think that was by design. We didn't hit it on all, like Mercury and Suns were kind of close, you know, but, you know, and some we didn't, like Liberty just seemed to be too easy. And like the Knick, what's the counterpart to a Knick, you know? And so it was like, okay, well, you know, on a couple, the Sparks one was really hard for us. I've worked on a couple of different projects for Los Angeles in sports. It's just a hard market to like create names for, because it doesn't have a lot of indigenous things besides surf or water or, you know, stars. And it's one of those things you think, oh, you've got all these symbols right away. And then you step back and you say, yeah, we don't really have all that many symbols, you know, so let's kind of just make it flashy.
Right.
So that's how the Sparks came along. It's just flashy, just like LA. So, you know, that's how that one kind of all came together.
I love how y'all, especially with when you look at, well, I think part of it too has a major, it was the complement of the actual logo and the way that you incorporated, for example, the palm tree in the Sparks.
Yeah.
So that you almost, you know, it doesn't even really phase you. And I think too, the beauty of it is Sparks within itself makes you kind of pay attention. It's a buzzword. And on top of that, you had, you know, Lisa Leslie dunking, you had her creating this, she became one of the, you know, core brand ambassadors for the game very early on. They were winning. They were fun to watch. And there was a lot of, you know, buzz around the team, especially given the locale. And I thought to myself, you know, it was like that with a few teams, you know, especially when you look at New York Liberty and the type of players that were on the team, especially Teresa Weatherspoon, especially when she hit that shot.
Yes.
You know, these teams were creating iconic moments that we look back at now that we have something to compare to. Because, like, when we saw last season, Derrica Hamby, she stood up there and hit that game-winning, you know.
Right.
It's just like we're able to compare now. And, you know, of course, we're still in the infancy almost of the league. It's still very young, but it's like that we have, like, it's the shot 2.0. And so I think when you look at, you go back and look at, I think people have appreciation now going back and looking at the old jerseys and things like that. I thought, well, I'm curious, what was the logo that actually took the longest to create, or how much time did y'all spend on?
Wow. That's a great question. So I got to like open the memory bank on that one. I think one that it might not have been the first year, but the second year was the Detroit Shock.
Okay.
Like, because Shock in itself is kind of a, like, you know, it's like this weird word, where Spark was more like, okay, palm tree, you know, Lakers color is pretty easy. But here, right in Detroit at the same time, you know, they had that really static Pistons logo, the Bad Boys logo, right? Mm-hmm. And just about the same time that we were doing the Shock logo, we were changing the logo of the Pistons to that teal, the Grand Hill teal era.
Okay.
And that's like, shoo, you know, that's way, like, you know, speaks to the 90s, like right down the fairway. And then over here, we've got this name that we're not really sure of what to do with. And so that was hard, more of just as a designer for a positioning statement. Like, do we try to get any intrinsic value out of the, you know, the Pistons new logo, which we did use the color palette, although we featured the red instead of the teal. But then what do we match up with Piston? What's that word, you know? And then when we said Shock, is like, is it a shock absorber, or is it just shock when you're like, you're shocked, you know? And so we had like three or four paths for the logo, and I didn't like any of them. So I was like, you know, Val and David were like, what's going on? I'm like, I don't know. It's just goofy to me. They're like, well, too bad. You got to make it work. And then when we finally got the thing that kind of fit all together and this and that, you know, it came together. But that one, I think, was more, it wasn't frustrating, but it was just like, what should this really be? You know? And, that was one of the hardest ones. The favorite one of mine, and I still love the logo to this day, and I have it here. I keep it close to me because I think it's one of the best logos in all of sports, was the Miami Soul logo.
Yes.
This thing, I look at this. There was like a patch on eBay for like $30. I'm like, I'm buying it. I just love this thing. I love the way it worked. I just love, you know, the color palette. It just balanced so well. Their uniforms are so sharp and clean. And, you know, to have the Heat and the Soul kind of fit, you know, like this probably would have been a better name for the Suns. So you'd have the Suns and the Soul. But at the end of the day, I just thought they didn't have a long life. So that was one of those teams that didn't play very long. But when I've gone back and studied some of the graphics we've done for the league, just really like that's spot on. It looked great at center court. It looked great on the warmups. They had, a black, a red front and a black back. And I was just like, That's a good look. That's a really good look. And has the ball right in the middle. I think it's the only logo of all of them that has the WNBA ball smack dab in the middle. So you probably be like, oh, what's your favorite logo? You wouldn't probably expect that one to be on the top of the list because it didn't have a long shelf life, It seems like I've got that touch. I did the Vancouver Grizzlies logo for the NBA, and that that petered out pretty fast. But anyway, so that's kind of like, that was the toughest one for me, was the shock, just because it's such a nebulous thing, you know? And so you've got to create the story for the viewer, and it's not good to get shocked. But shockingly, we got it done. So,
I'm curious about a couple of expansion teams. So, mm-hmm. Curious on your thoughts about, now it's by far that I can recall, it's the brightest, it's the brightest logo, color palette, color scheme that we've seen of all the teams in the Dallas Wings. Uh-huh. What are your thoughts on those bright green jerseys?
Somehow that neon trend has gotten popular. Maybe it was the neon shoes that Nike was doing maybe about 7 or 8 years ago with really bright, fluorescent shoes, and that just permeated up into the uniforms. I know that it would probably make more sense if it was like the Minnesota Lynx wearing it, because the Timberwolves have that whacked neon green uniform. So I'd say, well, whatever they're doing, at least they're doing it together. The Wings is a great name for a team, you know, but I don't know, There must be some study now that WNBA did to say this is a great color to feature, you know. But I think it's in small doses. I think bright colors can work, but I think they have to be in very small doses. So if it was that, you know, it's so funny you bring that up, because I'm wearing my old Atlanta Hawks shirt, the old Pete Maravich shirt, and that's kind of the Wings color, right? The blue?
Yes.
And then they had this neon color?
Correct.
But it's not the neon version. I have the blue on. Because it looks pretty good, and then there's just enough trim to, like, brighten it up a little bit, you know?
Right.
And I think that's where it's flipped around. Like, if you had a dominant blue uniform, then you would just maybe trim it with the neon green. But, you know, to each their own. I mean, I don't know. If they have, you know, if they draft a couple superstars, the neon green uniform will be a lot more popular, you know, than it is now. I'm going to go off subject for a second, but it's a little weird because so much of the branding now has become more like soccer, you know?
Right.
And so I don't know if you were going to ask me that question or not, but I completely understand the financial ramifications of having a sponsor to support you and provide you with good revenue for the team and the market. But then there's that flip side where when I look back on all those early uniforms of the WNBA, my eyeballs just pop out at how interesting they are and how colorful they are and how they all look a little similar, but they all look different.
Right.
And you really become, have a tribal connection to that Comets uniform or that Liberty uniform, you know, and the Sparks uniform. And I think you lose a little bit of that when you have to go into the corporate world with the branding, you know. And I completely understand it, and it hasn't hurt soccer. So, but I just think that there's that tipping point where just you start to lose a little bit of brand equity when the sponsor has a dominant place on the uniform.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I got to get over it. And I think a lot of people have to get over it. That's the new reality, you know?
No, you're absolutely right. And that definitely was a question I was going to ask about the jerseys. Now, so when it came to the Orlando Miracle, and you of course mentioned the Minnesota Lynx earlier, those were the first two expansion teams that y'all had to focus on. Talk a bit about the process to determine their team identities.
Again, trying to align the Miracle with the Magic was key. So we were trying to pull together the essence of what the Magic had, because they'd be playing at the old arena in Orlando. And we wanted to have the same color palette because you don't have to change the color of the courts, right? So they're playing on the same courts. And then over time, the Miracle became a name that was provided by the team. So that was something we were provided with. I think the DeVos family at the time was owners of the franchise. And so we were given that name. I mean, I don't remember if it was a long process or something that just was basically say, hey, they kind of like this for the name of the team. And, you know, even as the second and third year started up, more and more of the teams are getting a little bit more input into what the direction would go of their franchises because they hadn't stepped up the first time. So now as the league started getting more popular, you know, David says, okay, as we pull in these markets that are seeing the light, we're going to have to give them a little bit more brand traction because they're going to be starting fresh. You have to remember, Jasmine, when you have a first year, you kind of have a free shot at it because people are interested in the novelty of it. Sure. And people are interested in being there early and getting season tickets cheaply and, you know, all those different things. But, you know, that's kind of how it works. So when it's all said and done, when you're coming in the second year or third year and the popularity is shifting, you know, I think we had to give them a little bit more, you know, of the responsibility to say, hey, we got a running start. So what kind of tools do you think you're going to need to make it successful now that we've got some momentum, you know, and how are you going to position it because you weren't in that first pass, you know? So that was it. And you said the Miracle and the other team was the Lynx, right?
Right.
The Lynx was really a pretty they just really love women's basketball up there. That was not a very hard market to figure out. When we came in there, it was like, go, go, go. And the color palette was, we tried to do somewhat similar to the Timberwolves logo, which was the full face without the trees and just use a Lynx face with, I think, the basketball and the type above it. So those were kind of complementary logos, I thought. And I think that they sat next to each other nicely on any kind of, you know, Target Center promotional materials or whatever. So that one wasn't very difficult. That one seemed to kind of come together nicely. We had the guy who did the logo, the illustrator. He also did the Bucks logo and the Atlanta Hawks logo. His name was Dick Sakahara. And he is an accomplished illustrator of animals. He's done the Cubs secondary logo. He's got a long resume of doing these really flat, powerful graphics that use black and white space really nicely. And I've known him for a long time. And so when we'd have a really challenging project like that, I would reach out to Dick and say, can you give us a rendering of the artwork? And then I'll work the type around it. Whatever you give me, I can make it work within, you know, a frame of, you know, a 3x4 frame. And I'd say, okay, you gave me the Hawks logo. I'm like, okay, I just got to put some type above that. That's absolutely beautiful, you know? So that's how some of those logos are done through a joint dealing where we're kind of like, okay, I'm not going to be able to draw it any better than that. Let the master come in and do it. We'll pay him his nice fees. And then we'll go ahead and we'll make it work throughout everything else. So he's part of our WNBA folklore, the Lynx logo designer.
That's dope. Yeah, I mean, and as you know, they went on to, you know,
yes,
and became another dynasty.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
But
and great and good population, right? Like their fans, they supported the team. But it was like that right out of the box.
Yes, like, I could see that. I could definitely see that. I mean, when I went, I've only gone to one All-Star Weekend, and it was in 2018 when they had it in Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And the fan base was absolutely, like, I was just, like, taken aback once it was actual game day. I was completely taken aback and in awe of that.
And it was like that almost from the start. It just, that was a good market for the WNBA.
Definitely. I mean, they love their women's basketball, and it's awesome. Yeah. I think that's kind of like how it is too, even in Texas, where it's a thing for sure.
Yes.
Now, like I mentioned, All-Star Weekend. Talk about the first jerseys and gear for All-Star Weekend, the first one that y'all had.
Oh, well, that was, you know, by then, we were trying to figure out the best way to, you know, have a uniform that, you know, that would be provocative for the players, you know, but still perform and still kind of fit within the realm of what we were doing with, you know, the regular team identities. And, you know, sometimes I would be pushing for something a little different, you know, like, but I would usually kind of stub my toe. Like, you know, I like back in the day when the players had the, you know, the untucked jerseys, like what Marquette used to do and some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I always thought that All-Star Game uniform should be kind of a moment in time.
Yes.
Because you're playing it, you wear it, and then on to the next thing. And so I felt like there's always more of a trendy aspect to a uniform for an All-Star game. And so you could get away with what's kind of the hot thing at the time, because it just marks a moment in time. And it's nice to look back on some of the years of the NBA and all the different uniform styles from the different eras back to the early 50s and forward to today, and see all the movement and the changes and the designs change over time and reflecting society and the, you know, along with the hairstyles and the way the equipment is, it's fun to see the uniform evolve and change, you know. And that's what, you know, we did some pretty crazy stuff on the NBA side in 1995 and 96 with Phoenix and with San Antonio. Yeah. Yeah. And, boy, those are still some of the most popular. Mitchell and Ness is making a fortune on some of the work I did 25 years ago. That stuff seems to be omnipresent, you know. And it's kind of weird because it's something that was done so long ago, and it's obviously looks dated. It has no, you know, if somebody said design the All-Star uniform today, I wouldn't do that, you know. But it was right for the time, and we pushed it through everything. It was on the courts and on the tickets and on the this and on that. I mean, those are complete brand packages that I think kind of elevated sports design in general, not just the NBA, but how the Super Bowl would coordinate all of their internal graphics and signage, and into the 2000s when LED boards came into vogue and all that, you know. So I think that early in the middle 90s, again, we were changing the landscape, you know. And so that's kind of what I remember about that, you know. It was all systems go, you know. So.
Definitely iconic. Again, I can't stress that enough.
Yeah.
Is there any way that you can convince Mitchell and Ness to finally give us WNBA vintage jerseys? Because between that and the fact that WNBA jerseys have never gotten the proper alternative jerseys, city version jerseys like the NBA has gotten, is a bit appalling. I'm kind of disappointed. I think a lot of fans have been disappointed about that, considering how dope these jerseys have been.
I'm kind of all in with you on that, you know. And I kind of after I did that little feed about the WNBA, just because I just wanted to create a little content. You're right. I zinged Mitchell Ness and I said, you know, when are we seeing the throwback WNBA jerseys? You know, like the time has come, you know. And I can't imagine how popular those would be, you know. And this is a weird summer because of COVID, but, you know, being in Chicago during the summertime, our biggest concert here is Lollapalooza, and it's like a big, it's a big deal. Like they take the city over for 4 days, and to watch, and to go out to Michigan Avenue and just walk along the street, I get such a kick out of it because I don't go in there. I would like faint, but at the end of the day to watch, oh, here comes a Grizzlies replica. Oh, and there's a, you know, a Hornets, Larry Johnson, you know, like replica, and everybody wearing, you know, the what they call not the hipsters, but the hoopsters wearing those replicas, and they're everywhere. And you go on eBay and it's like $90 for like a Charles Barkley. I'm like, what in the hell caused this? You know? And like, I would think it would be so cool to have that same kind of thing happening where the ladies would wear it, you know, and have the tank tops and like, because they're wearing the guy's jersey. I'm like, yeah, it doesn't look good on you, but a WNBA, the wider sleeve would look awesome. That's one of the things we had with those WNBA uniforms was that nice wider strap on the top, you know, which sat better. It didn't move around. And I just thought those were so nice. So you're preaching to the converted on that one. I have no idea why they wouldn't do that, especially because those don't have the corporate branding. You know, they don't have the Motorola or whoever is corporate sponsor du jour. They have those clean, crisp graphics that we really worked hard on, you know. And some of the word marks, like, you know, just to brag, I think some of the word marks are spectacular, like Monarchs and, you know, some of the fonts that we had on there. I thought they were so sharp and crispy, and they held together really well on the front of those uniforms. And or the Sting, and I'm thinking of even the Liberty was with the little torch in the eye, you know, like that stuff was clever. We were churning it out, like, just let's make it clever, fast, good, interesting, go, you know. So there wasn't the real deep thought put into it, because we were on a roll. We kind of had in the back of our mind how we were going to execute, do this, make the numbers big, do the contrast. You know, the initial run of those uniforms, if you look carefully at them the first year or two, there's really only what we call three silhouettes. And so a silhouette is like, okay, either one has got the side inserts with a little cut on the top and a little thing, or one kind of does like a little lacrosse raglan, so three of them are going to be that way. So when we started to design the uniforms with Champion for the inaugural season of WNBA, even though it looks like there's eight uniforms there, there's really only three what you'd call cuts. And so we're just replacing, you know, the teal for the Sting with the orange for the Mercury or whatever. You know, like if you look really carefully at those early pictures, the templates are preset a little bit, because Champion just could not commit to doing eight different designs with eight different cuts. It was just going to be too much, too fast.
That makes sense.
And you know, quite honestly, they were taking a big business gamble. And so they're telling us, hey, we're going to do this, but we have to do certain things we normally would not do based upon knowing the time involved, the risk on the financial side. You know, it might not be here next year, so we can't go too far down the fairway. But to their credit, they delivered.
They did.
They did a beautiful job. Yeah.
Yes. Even if you go back and look at the and I forget which, because I know that Reebok and Nike, and it's been a few different brands who have done the USA women's jerseys, but the ones that recently resurfaced where they were going to do it for this summer, the old adage to the 96.
Those are mine.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my, those are my favorite ones.
With the script.
Yes.
And the kind of bouncy line inside. Yeah, the light blue. I don't know what provoked us to do that. And Champion still hates me. Because they're like, what in the hell is this? And I'm like, well, it's different. Like, it's meant to be more like, you know, it's not just like some piping that you guys could do in your sleep. It's like, oh, they hated that. They just hated that. But yeah, and that had the stars on the sides. And so there was things that we did in there that were, you know, different. And that was the 96. And we did similar thing for the men's team. You know, when you see them, you kind of put them side by side. They're somewhat, you know, somewhat similar. But I was like, I didn't know they were doing that this year. And one day I just saw a Twitter feed. And I'm like, wow, those are spectacular. And they're better produced. if you look at the line work on the 96, it's kind of like, it's kind of like they tried. Right. And today it looks like they did it, you know, like it's a little different. Well, the script was kind of like popular then, you know, that's that 90s script. And so they did it. And the kind of the big, almost like Orlando Magic numbers are on the front of those things. And right. So I don't know what provoked us to pick the Orlando Magic numbers, but they kind of look fun. And so, yeah, so that's how that all came together. That's one of my favorite designs for the – we would be – the NBA Properties Group would be subcontracted to be the licensor for USA men's and women's basketball.
Okay.
So they didn't have a design department. They were just okay. Like almost like the federation. So they manage the games, manage the players, manage the schedules, the travel. Okay. But then we were kind of the marketing arm for all that. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that we did the men's basketball uniforms starting in 96, 2000. And I think the design I did, even though I left the league in 2003, was used in 2004. So yeah. So I think I had three shots at it. And a couple of those years are great. Like the Vince Carter year, that uniform is just slick. Yes. So slick.
But again, the players really made those jerseys. Like at the end of the day, because you can recall what yes. team that was, who was on yeah. that team, if they won gold or not. And I think that's what made that that jersey so iconic. Because to me, I still look at the 95-96 team as the most important, probably next to USC's women's basketball team that had Coop. And the McGee twins and Miller on that team. Those are the two most iconic women's basketball teams of all time to me, because they really set, you know, the bar. They set the foundation for what we know now as not only women, not only the WNBA, but just women's basketball in general. Because later on, you know, of course, you know, Pat Summitt was in Tennessee, basically creating her own dynasty as well. So it was just a great time to be a fan of women's basketball in particular. So when you talk about the 90s, like you said earlier, it was the colors. It was how basketball was being looked at. You also looked at kind of like how hip hop was affecting so much of the landscape of I guess that a fusion of basketball and hip hop. And you saw there were a lot of black sitcoms on television too, because what you ended up seeing was the first of all, the slogan "We Got Next," that was the first WNBA slogan. And then next thing you know, we're seeing the players in hip hop videos, rap videos. Then we see them on Martin, and it's just like, then we see these iconic Nike commercials that were just yes. like, oh my goodness. It was one thing after another. Can you really kind of talk about the marketing and how the WNBA, to me, I still look back at the 90s and I think that was the most relevant, I feel like, that the WNBA had been in terms of the mainstream culture. You know, and compared to, and mind you too, there weren't a bunch of different ways for us to consume the WNBA right. back then. Right. It was just TV for right. the most part. So can you just kind of talk about that time?
I think that what was really smart at the onset of the WNBA and just the marketing plan, besides the "We Got Next" slogan, was the marketing partners that were selected to join early on. And I think that David and, Val Ackerman and Rick Welts, who's president of NBA Properties at the time, and now he is the CEO of Golden State Warriors, who's in the Basketball Hall of Fame and is one of the most amazing people I've ever worked with. They convinced partners that it was going to be a privilege to be part of the first professional women's league that was going to be successful, to not look at it as an undertaking, but to look at it as a unique opportunity to be on board early. And so the way they positioned it was so intrinsically smart, to say, okay, Kellogg's or okay, Sears or okay, the companies that they aligned with early were family brands, you know? And so it was like, knowing that, you know, women make, I don't have the stats in front of me, 60% of the purchases in store and do the shopping for the household and all those different things. And then to create a fashion component to make sure that there's a style to the graphics, there's a style to the merchandise that we'd be creating. A shoe company would come in and take advantage of the fact that they could mold and melt something from the beginning. And I think that's what was so attractive to that original group of sponsors that jumped on board and kind of helped carry the ball with us for a while. I don't think they were one year deals. I think that we wanted like a 3-year commitment from them. And Champion, who was the outfitter, you know, they had developed, their business was built off of jog bras back in the late '70s and early '80s. That's what really built their company. Along with some, you know, the undergarments and the performance stuff, the old sweatshirts and the stuff that you'd wash 8 billion times and they would never fall apart, you know. And so the collection of partners, I think, really accelerated the popularity, you know. And so when you were going to have a broadcast on a Saturday afternoon, it was going to be a Sears spot. Well, why not have Lisa Leslie in a commercial during a non-NBA, a WNBA game, you know, that has a WNBA player in it? And I think we were really good at getting the players on some of the late night shows, like, you know, early on that they made appearances and you'd see them come out and not be just one of them, but three of them, you know. And so I think there was this, they were very likable players. I mean, there's no doubt about it, you know. They were charming, they're charismatic, they're intelligent, they were athletic. And yet they had a certain, I think when the Beatles, this is how old I am, when the Beatles first came to the United States, there was a charm and a charisma and a playfulness about them. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like, I even felt like with the guys early on, you know, like Michael and Magic and Larry, those guys would bust chops off the court all the time. You always felt like they were ready to kill each other once they walked onto the court. But off of it, there was always kind of this, you know, like tongue-in-cheek thing going on. And I think the ladies did that as well, where they had this kind of certain style to them. And the, you know, it was a competitive sport right away. You know, it wasn't what I think was really important was when this league started, it never felt like an exhibition.
Right.
It wasn't a Globetrotters game. They were kicking ass and they wanted to win. And it was like right off the start, you know, like you could watch a game for 5 minutes and say, this is legit stuff. This is not just, you know, the last thing this is pandering, you know, these are people that really mean business, you know? And so I think people appreciate that, you know, and it's professional basketball at a fraction of the price. That also helps, you know, right?